संसारे श्री कृष्ण चैतन्य प्रभु दया करो मोरे जगत संसारे हाथी का भावना है तो हवा बतारा मौसम पची का प्रभु न पाइले हाथी का भावना है तो Nanda Sukhi Kripa Balokana Koro Ami Boro Dukhi Mahaprabhu Nityananda Premananda Sukhi Kripa Balokana Koro Ami Boro Kuroshita Pati Advaita Goshai Tava Tripa Bole Pai Chaitanya Nitai Daya Kuroshita Pati Advaita Goshai Tava Tripa Bole Swarupanatana Rupa Raghunataha Mbata Jiva Shijiva Prabhu Lokanataha Swarupanatana Rupa Raghunataha Mbata Jiva Shijiva Prabhu Lokanatha Daya Kara Shri Acharya Prabhu Srinivasa Ramachandra Sangama Je Narottama Dasa Chaitanya Prabhu Daya Koro More Kanchina Chedo Yagu Jagat Samsare Shri Krishna Chaitanya Prabhu Daya Koro More Kanchina Chedo Yagu
Jai Om Vishnupad Paramahamsa Parivrajaka Acharya Stotra Sata Shri Shri Mata's Divine Grace A.C. Bhakti Vedanta Swami Shri the Prabhupada Ki Jai Ananta Koti Vaishnava Vrinda Ki Jai Shri Chaitanya Charitamrita Ki Jai All glories to the assembled devotees. All glories to the assembled devotees. All glories to the assembled devotees. All glories to Sri Sri Guru and Gauranga. All glories to Sri Prabhupada. All right, I was prepared to speak on verse 15 here, but the book was on verse 12. So, anyway. Jaya Jaya Sri Chaitanya Jaya Nityananda. Jaya Jaya Sri Chaitanya Jaya Nityananda. Jaya Deta Chandra Jaya Gaura Bhakta Vrinda. Jaya Deta Chandra Jaya Gaura Bhakta Vrinda. So it is 15. First 15? Yes. Okay, good.
Chapter what?
Oh, yes. Today we are reading from the Sri Chaitanya Charitamrita of Krishnadas Kaviraj Goswami. Madhya Lila, chapter 21, verse number 15. You're going to have to forgive me. In trying to prepare for this class, I tried to get the meter for this verse down, which would appear to be the Brahma Samhita meter, but it's like two syllables longer, so I don't know. I'm just going to read the word-for-word translation. Jupataya, the predominating deities of higher planetary systems. Lord Brahma and others. Eva, also. Te, your. Na, not. Yayu, could reach. Antam, the limit of transcendental qualities. Anantataya, due to being unlimited. Tvam api, you also. Yat, since. Antara, within you. Andanichaya, the groups of universes. Nanu, O sir. Savarna, having different coverings. Ke, in the sky. Eva, like. Rajamsi, atoms. Vanti, rotate. Vayasa, the course of time. Saha, with. Yat, what. Shrutaya, great personalities who understand the Vedas. Tvayi, in you. He, certainly. Palanti, and in. Uh-oh. Antanirasanena, by refuting the inferior elements. Bhavat nidana, whose conclusion is in you. Translation and purport by His Divine Grace, A.C. Bhaktivedanta Swami Prabhupada. Srila Prabhupada ki. Translation. My Lord, you are unlimited. Even the predominating deities of the higher planetary systems, including Lord Brahma, could not find your limitations. Nor could you yourself ascertain the limit of your qualities. Like atoms in the sky, there are multi-universes with seven coverings, and these are rotating in due course of time. All the experts in Vedic understanding are searching for you by eliminating the material elements. In this way, searching and searching, they come to the conclusion that everything is complete in you. Thus, you are the resort of everything. This is the conclusion of all Vedic experts. Purport. This verse from Srimad Bhagavatam 10:87:41 is confirmed in Bhagavad Gita. Bahunam janmanam ante jnanavan mam prapadyate vasudeva sarvam iti sa mahatma sudurlabha. After many births and deaths, he who is actually in knowledge surrenders unto me, knowing me to be the cause of all causes and all that is. Such a great soul is very rare. After searching for the absolute truth throughout the universe, learned scholars and Vedic experts cannot reach the ultimate goal. In this way, they come to Krishna. When there is a discussion about the absolute truth, there are always various pros and cons. The purpose of such arguments is not to come to the right conclusion. Such an argument is generally known as neti-neti, not this, not that. Until one comes to the right conclusion, the process of thinking, this is not the absolute truth, that is not the absolute truth, will continue. When we come to the right conclusion, we accept the Supreme Personality of Godhead, Krishna, as the ultimate truth. Om Anjanata Nirandasya Gananjana Shalakaya Chakshur Unnalitamina Tasmai Shri Guruve Namaha Shri Chaitanya Manobisham Shtapitam Nina Bhutale Svayam Rupa Kadamayam Dadati Sva Padantikam Vansha Kalpatarubhyascha Kripa Sindhuvya Evacha Patitanam Pavanevya Vaishnavevya Namah Namaha Jai Shri Krishna Chaitanya Prabhu Nityananda Shri Advaita Gadadhar Shri Vasari Gaura Bhakta Vrinda Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare. Hare Ram, Ram Ram, Hare Hare. So this verse was originally spoken in the prayers of the personified Vedas at the end of the 10th canto of the Srimad Bhagavatam. And it's being repeated here by Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu to Sanatana Goswami as part of the ongoing instructions of Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu to Sanatana Goswami. And this is approaching the end of the Madhya Lila of the Chaitanya Charitamrita. And so we're approaching the Antya Lila, or the sort of the end game pastimes of Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, if you will. And so this is the instructions of Chaitanya Mahaprabhu to Sanatana Goswami are sort of a seminal moment in the history of Gaudiya Vaishnavism. And then following that by the instructions that he gave to Sanatana Goswami's brother, Rupa Goswami, these two conversations found in the Chaitanya Charitamrita really form the core or the heart of what Gaudiya Vaishnavism is today. And of course, Chaitanya Mahaprabhu had so many discussions with so many people that inform our understanding of Krishna and bhakti and devotional culture and history and philosophy and theology and metaphysics and all of these things. But we are followers of Chaitanya Mahaprabhu in the line of Rupa and Raghunath. So this is a key moment or a key point in the Bhagavatam. In the Chaitanya Charitamrita. And before the discussion with Sanatana Goswami began, of course, we heard about Sanatana Goswami's qualifications for hearing from Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. And so it's not just that anybody can hear the Veda, you know, directly from the source of the Veda, Krishna himself appearing as Krishna's devotee. But Sanatana Goswami actually went to great lengths to hear from Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. It was not a casual visit on a Sunday, expecting to get the little drops of nectar to lead us back to Godhead. And that's not a criticism of the people who can only show up here for little drops of nectar on a Sunday. But Sanatana Goswami escaped from prison to go see Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, and then he walked halfway across India. Yeah. More or less. Where exactly was he imprisoned? He was imprisoned in Bangladesh or West Bengal, and he walked to Vrindavan, which is, I mean, that's a 36-hour train ride, or at least the last time I took that train ride, it was a 36-hour. What's that? A little less than before, the Indian infrastructure has improved since the last time I took that train, right? Yeah. No doubt. But still, that's a long walk. It's got to be 1,000 miles. It's got to be 1,000 miles, I think. We can look it up. So we walked that far, you know, and of course, you know, we have trouble walking from right over there to right over here to go see Krishna. But that's a conversation another time. So Sanatana Goswami went to great lengths to hear from Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, and he also gave up a lot along the way. And this whole kind of pastime, or this whole kind of illustrative story, ends with, Lord Chaitanya embraced Sanatana Goswami, and he introduced Sanatana Goswami to all of his associates where he was, and he was very pleased with him, but he was not very pleased with the fact that Sanatana Goswami was maintaining some attachment to a really nice chadar, and this really nice blanket that he had somehow acquired on along the way. And Sanatana Goswami found out somehow that Lord Chaitanya wasn't too happy about this, and so he gave up his chadar and found some old rag to wrap himself with. And in the summary of that chapter, which is chapter 20, Bhaktivinoda Thakur points out explicitly that that was the bonus point that gave Sanatana Goswami the qualification to hear Lord Chaitanya's instructions. And then Lord Chaitanya instructed Sanatana Goswami for a long time. I think a month, 30 days. So can you imagine? You know, we have trouble sitting for a lecture for, you know, an hour, hour and a half. Sometimes we even have trouble speaking for that long. But for 30 days, Chaitanya Mahaprabhu instructed Sanatana Goswami, and this covered everything from the lowest, most basic points of bhakti yoga through things that we cannot really possibly perceive of, including what is, or conceive of, I should say, including what's being spoken of in this verse cited from the prayers of personified Vedas, which has to do with the nature of the material universes that we live in and how it is impossible for anybody to really understand the breadth and the depth and the time scale in which all of the things that we can perceive in the universe truly and factually exist beyond the limited powers of our sense perception. And I find this purport in this verse appropriate for today for a couple reasons. Number one, in my next engagement today, the Bhaktivedanta Institute is having a very large conference on matters concerning the fifth canto of the Srimad Bhagavatam and matters concerning cosmology and cosmogony, which is the creation of the cosmos. And many scholars, both devotional scholars, a few secular scholars also, from all over the country have come. And it's a pretty large, certainly our largest production to date in our current incarnation of the Bhaktivedanta Institute. But I'm always reminded of the statement of Lord Brahma himself in the second canto, when the universe was revealed to him for the first time by Krishna. And Lord Brahma, who is the most intelligent living entity in the universe, he is pure intelligence. He is a body made of pure intelligence. So our bodies are made of all of the different elements, right? Including subtle elements, ahankara, mana, buddhi, intelligence, false ego, and mind. Lord Brahma's body is made of pure intelligence, and even he cannot understand the universes that Krishna has created. So what is our, you know, position to understand these things truly and factually? So why bother at all? Like, why not just chant Hare Krishna and eat some more pumpkin pie in honor of the Thanksgiving season when everybody gets to eat pumpkin pie? And the reason is because it's human nature to want to answer these questions. That is what makes humans different from all other species of living entities that we know of. All living entities undergo the basic functions of life, which our Srila Prabhupada summarized very succinctly in eating, sleeping, mating, and defending. Right? Prabhupada did not mince words. This is what all life is doing. If you take a modern biology class, they'll elaborate on that a little bit. They have eight features of life. I won't go into too many details, but you can definitely summarize all eight of those features into eating, sleeping, mating, and defending, right? And these are like biological imperatives. Biological imperative is something that you have to do based on the constitution of your body, right? So we have to eat. Your body will demand that you eat. And I've said this several times, and I think this is also appropriate given the global state of war right now, that even in the most dire of circumstances, when there's no food and no water and no shelter, people will find a way to find something to eat. They have to. They have to. You have to sleep. People don't sleep, they go crazy. They start to lose their mental faculties very quickly. And in fact, sleep deprivation is a common method of like low-key torture. You know, you take away people's right to sleep, they will start to go mad, and then they can be manipulated. And it's the same with mating and defending. The overwhelming majority of people in the world have just a biological impulse to start and raise a family. There's something about the cells in our body that in course of time, they mature, they ripen, and they demand of the living entity that you procreate. And this is not unique just to humans, this is all life that we perceive of, is forced by their biological constitution to procreate. And then when we procreate, of course, we are attached to our children. We are attached to our offspring. And if anybody has any sense of morality or good intention in the world, they will endeavor their best to take care of their offspring. because they see themselves living on in future generations through their progeny. And so we defend, we try to accumulate things for our personal safety and shelter, and we try to keep other people from taking those things away from us, either on a gross or a subtle platform, or both, usually both, right? But human life is different. Human life has the added feature is in that having come to the human form of life, after evolving through so many millions of different species of life, that we've evolved through to come to this human form of life, this thing that sets human life apart from all of the rest of the life is that we have the ability to ask the question, what is happening? Like, what is going on here? Where did this all come from? Why am I here? Sanat Goswami, of course, asked Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, after Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu had glorified him for being a great learned scholar and a powerful political figure, Sanat Goswami acknowledged that he might be all of that, but in fact, he was a great fool because he did not know why he was here and why he was forced to suffer the threefold miseries of material existence. And so that's when human life really begins. You know, a human being who is not asking those questions is really not a human being from the perspective of Vedic knowledge. They're just a two-legged animal, and that's an important distinction to be made. And so what are the answers to these questions? That is what Chaitanya Mahaprabhu taught Sanat Goswami over these 30 days. Who are you, and why are you forced to suffer the threefold miseries of material existence? You know, and so the answers to these questions arise in human society in the form of knowledge institutions. And for most of human history, those knowledge institutions were controlled by a Brahminical or a priestly class. The knowledge in the society was the property of a religious class of plutocrats, of rulers, basically. And this is true all across human society. This is not unique to India or the West or Europe. This is true all over the world. We could say indigenous cultures, the knowledge keepers are shamans or priests or brahmanas or, you know, people of this ilk. And we've seen throughout human history that there's a tendency for people in power to misuse their power in some cases. But we also see that because we're all human, you know, people make mistakes. And as a growing backlash, or as it could be seen as a growing backlash, or it could also be seen as a natural evolution of wanting to know about the world that we live in, more recently in human society, we've developed a thing called the scientific method. And so indigenous knowledge, knowledge held by a Brahminical or a priestly class, this dates back in human society far longer, thousands of years longer than what we refer to as science today. And in fact, the word science wasn't even prevalent in the English language until nearly the end of the 19th century. I mean, the idea that somebody could grow up to be a scientist really wasn't something that was prevalent in the West until around the beginning of World War I and thereafter. And so that also puts some context as to why Prabhupada spoke so strongly about and against scientists, is that this was an ever growing influence on society. But even if we look at science from the context of rational thought and philosophy dating back to the ancient Greeks or whatever, the knowledge of the Bhagavad still predates that by a long time in human society. But what is science? And I find it interesting because when we teach philosophy of science, and I've taught philosophy of science both at a university level, and we also teach philosophy of science to our kids here at the Bhaktivedanta Academy as just a matter of understanding theories of knowledge. What is knowledge? A central point of the scientific method is that science can never prove anything. The universe is way too big to have conclusive scientific proof about anything. And a good scientist will know that. The only thing that science can do is disprove something. And disprove something means I make a hypothesis, I make a claim about the universe, and I develop methods to test that claim. And that claim remains viable until one of my tests shows that it's not true. So you can't show that it is true. You can only show that it's not true. And that's what Prabhupada is speaking of here in the purport, that's why I'm going off on this tangent again about science. There was a point about the purport here. I apologize. This is what Prabhupada's speaking about here in the purport when he's speaking about this neti-neti process. This is a type of a meditation that a yogi will do. They'll sit in a proper yogi position and they'll begin to ask themselves, who are they? Just like Sanatana Goswami asks, who am I? And we'll start, am I my toe? No, I'm not my toe. Well, then, am I my whole foot? No, I'm not my whole foot. And you can get more comprehensive about the different parts of the body that I might be, first on a gross level, then on a subtle level. Am I my mind? Am I my mind? No, I'm not my mind. There's so much evidence of that, that when my mind is inactive, all of the functions of my body continue, right? When I'm sleeping, or if I get knocked out in a fight, something. That's never happened. Maybe it happens. No. So on and so forth. So this is the neti-neti thing. It's not this, it's not that. So we can say what is not the absolute truth. But it's very difficult to say what is the absolute truth. Although we have a tendency to search for it. So what do we do? Is the search endless? Will it ever go on? Will we ever find the answers that we're looking for? But we see here that actually the absolute truth can be revealed to us. And that is what Lord Chaitanya is doing with Sanatana Goswami here. He is revealing the absolute truth to him. He can show it. It was the same with Arjuna on the battlefield of Kurukshetra. We cannot see the universal form of Krishna. What we see as the universal form of Krishna, when we look up at the sky at night and see the stars in the heavens, or the sun shining in the daytime, or if we see the rivers flowing on the earth, like the blood running through the veins of the universal form, or the trees of the great forest of the earth standing up like the hairs on the body of the universal form. We are not really seeing the universal form of Krishna. We are seeing a point of the universal form of Krishna. We're looking at an aspect of it. But to comprehend the whole thing in one go, this is not possible with human sensory perceptions. But it can be revealed to us as Krishna revealed the universal form to Arjuna and others. Krishna revealed the universal form to Mother Yashoda in part. Krishna revealed his universal form to Duryodhana, which ultimately saved Duryodhana from a very hellish existence. And he saw the universal form of Krishna and he just had this one moment of belief. You know, we sometimes think of like moments of doubt. I'm having a moment of weakness. I have this doubt in something. Duryodhana had a one moment of faith in Krishna after seeing the universal form that perhaps, maybe Krishna is God. And this saved him, ultimately. This one moment of thinking, perhaps Krishna is God. Krishna Chetraswami was talking to our 9th and 10th graders yesterday about faith, and he commented, I don't know how much the 9th and 10th graders learned. I learned a lot. One thing I learned was that the word faith is broken down into two pieces, shrad and da. Da is to put something somewhere, and shrad is the heart. So to have faith, shraddha, is to put something on your heart, or to put something in your heart. So Duryodhana put this in his heart for just a moment, that actually maybe Krishna is God. Not Krishna is God, maybe he is. And we hear from Srila Prabhupada in the introduction to the Bhagavad Gita that if you're going to try to imbibe some value from this book, you should at least theoretically accept that Krishna is who he says he is. So this is like an experiment. This is like an experiment. I remember we used to preach in Edmonton, independently of the ISKCON temple there. We used to rent a yoga studio once a month and do a program for university students in like the yoga scene. And we didn't like to give class too much. You know, I think that in the age of podcasts and TikTok and you know, just these like reels on Facebook or whatever, and all these like really sort of short attention span kind of media consumption that our society is plagued with today, people really aren't coming to hear a lecture like you all are, who've already, you know, gained some taste for this. And so we would mostly just chant and distribute prasadam, but we would always talk for 5 or 10 minutes about what is this chanting? What is this prasadam? What are we doing? And I would tell people, you know, you don't need to believe what I'm saying. You know, just go home and try it for yourself, right? go home and try it for yourself. Because the proof of the pudding is in the tasting, as they say. And Krishna confirms this also in the Bhagavad Gita with pratyaksha vargamam dharmyam, right? He says that the absolute truth can be directly perceived. Pratyaksha vargamam dharmyam. The truth can be perceived through the path of direct perception. But the problem with that is that in a conditioned state, the vehicles through which we are perceiving are both limited and contaminated. And so even if our senses were in a perfectly pure state, they would still be limited. And therefore, we need help. We need an intervention. And that intervention comes from Krishna through the Sampradaya, through the Guru Parampara, in the form of the Guru, so that we can hear, so that we can see. Because it's not only a matter of seeing, right? We try to perceive what's going on in the universe with our eyes, but this is only one faculty that we have. And our eyes can be deceiving, right? Sometimes we do not perceive things as we are, as they are. I like to use the example of if you go to the beach and you look out over the horizon will appear flat, right? And that's where people get this crazy idea that the earth is flat. If you look at the horizon on the beach just with your eyes, it will appear flat. But this is a very rudimentary type of observation. You're only using one of your senses, and there are no variables to alter, what's happening on the horizon. There's nothing interacting with the horizon to see how it behaves. So it appears one way to a certain type of observation, but as soon as you add more detail to the observation, the picture changes dramatically. And it's actually quite easy to perceive by standing on the shore of the ocean, if you know what you're looking at, that the earth isn't flat. And it's the same thing when we look out into space. We look out into space and we see all these stars, and scientists can shine their point their spectroscopes at it, which will analyze the quality of the light that the stars are emitting. And then based on long-standing pre-existing scientific theories, they'll put those patterns of light into a formula that they think they understand, and they'll come to a conclusion about what they think that star is made out of. Right? Based on the nature of the light that it's giving off. And this is 90% of what we know of the universe. And we can get more sophisticated with that. We can look at the actual color of visible light that the stars are giving off, and we see that if it has a certain amount of red and a certain amount of orange and a certain amount of blue, that means the star is fusing hydrogen to make helium. And if it's got a certain amount of green and yellow, I'm making these colors up. I don't know what these colors are off the top of my head. But the standard colors of the rainbow, these are signatures of what kind of chemical process is going on in the stars. So that's looking at the visible light. We can also look at non-visible forms of light, microwaves, gamma waves, radio waves, all this other stuff. So we have great radio telescopes. And using these radio telescopes, there were some researchers in the 1960s that were using a radioscope to analyze non-visible light, because this is how we perceive the universe. We look at it. We analyze the light. And this is 90% of what astronomers know about the universe that we live in, at least, maybe all of it. And these guys were using this radio telescope to, do some experiment or whatever, and everywhere they pointed the telescope, they were getting a buzz at a very specific frequency. I forgot what the frequency was. And they thought that there was a problem with the telescope, and so, they turned it off and turned it back on. They kicked it a couple times. They even sent a graduate student up into the dish of the radio telescope to try to clean off the pigeon poop. They thought that a pigeon had been pooping in the receiver, and so it wasn't getting a clear signal. And so they tried all of these troubleshooting methods until they finally just decided that what they were perceiving as this buzz wherever they pointed the radio telescope was actually something that was real in the universe. They had discovered the cosmic microwave background radiation. Which is something that was predicted by the Big Bang Theory 30 or 40 years earlier, and then had been discovered, and fits the Big Bang Theory very well, right? And the Bhagavatam doesn't contradict the Big Bang Theory. I just want to be clear about that. The Bhagavatam adds missing pieces of the puzzle to the Big Bang Theory. But this is what we perceive in the universe, right? And so all of these things that we perceive, scientists have managed to make them fit nicely into this theory to a certain extent. Of course, now with newer telescopes, especially in the last year or two with the James Webb the last year or so with the James Webb telescope. Now scientists are seeing things in the universe that don't agree with that theory, which is problematic. And the point of all of this detailed knowledge is to say only that us staring off into space with our telescopes is analogous to somebody standing on the shore of the ocean and seeing the horizon and thinking the Earth is flat, because they have no idea what they're looking at, or how to interact with what they're looking at, or how to see the interactions of things they're looking at, because it's all just too far away. We don't have the technology, we don't have the ability, we don't have the means. So it all just becomes a thought experiment. And the nature of humanity is that we don't want to change our beliefs. You know, like the Big Bang belief has been, you know, the dominant scientific paradigm of the last 100 years. And although that's a philosophical and a metaphysical issue, that has far-reaching implications in our society, right? In ways that we don't even perceive them. And that, again, to get back to this point, that's why Srila Prabhupada spoke so strongly about scientists becoming the Brahminical class of our time. It's not that Prabhupada spoke against science. Prabhupada acknowledged that science had brought a lot of good to human society. But what he repeatedly pushed back on was that through the scientific method, this neti-neti, the process of disproving things, we will never arrive at the conclusive absolute truth. The conclusive absolute truth is revealed to us when we become purified through the process of rendering submissive service to the spiritual master and asking relevant questions. That's the purification process. So what is the relevant questions? I'm circling back to this section of the Bhagavad Gita in the fourth canto, where it's describing action and inaction, and action in action, and inaction and action. And this becomes a tongue twister, and Arjuna is listening to all of this. And he's like, okay, this is interesting word play here, but what am I supposed to do now? And Krishna said, Pariprasnena Seva, that you should approach a spiritual master with an attitude of submissive service, not what can I get from you, Guru Maharaj, or whatever, but what can I do for you? Like the great words of John F. Kennedy, ask not what your country can do for you, ask what you can do for your country. So there has to be a mood of service, not a mood of self-gain or self-advancement, a mood of service. And there has to be relevant questions. How do we put this into practice in my life? In my life, not as a broad philosophical concept, but what can I do? And this is challenging, and this is a long road. This takes a while to get right. Bahunam janmanan ante. Gyanavamam prapadyante vasudeva sarvamiti samahatma sudurava. This is the verse that's quoted in the purport here, which says that after many, 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 many births, someone who is really knowledgeable will surrender to Krishna. And that's when spiritual life begins. And from that point of surrendering to Krishna to the point of achieving the supreme destination, or having all of our desires truly fulfilled by Krishna, right? We see that Krishna is fulfilling all of our small desires all the time, every day, in big and small ways. But what is it that we really desire? What is the heart's true desire? The heart's true desire is to be with Krishna in his abode eternally, playing in the river, running through the forests, or whatever it is that we will do with Krishna. This is what we really want. And from the time of the living entity in the material world first surrenders to Krishna, to the time where that becomes an irrevocable reality of our lives, that is a long, long journey. That is a long journey. That has been a long journey for most of us already, just in this lifetime. And what did we do to deserve the mercy of Lord Chaitanya? I mean, I ask myself this question all the time, actually. What did I do to deserve all of this mercy in my life? And the answer is nothing. I didn't do anything to deserve this. That's what makes it mercy, right? That's why it's the mercy. It just landed on us. I think about this in the context of Lord Chaitanya and Rupa Goswami and Gaudiya Vaishnavism and the acharyas that we have sitting on our altar here. And how did this wind up in Alachua, Florida? Prabhupada came to Alachua County, Florida, and he commented that this is a remote place, far removed from the birthplace of Lord Chaitanya. said it is a remote place, far removed from the birthplace of Lord Chaitanya. And then, of course, we think, let's go visit the birthplace of Lord Chaitanya. My God, this is 2 days on an airplane, right? You got to get to the airport. And then I haven't been in an airport in a long time, thankfully, since COVID started, after being in airports all the time. But it's just a hassle to get to Mayapur. And you think that Mayapur is actually a remote place off in the middle of nowhere, the swamps of the Ganges. But Prabhupada had this vision that the central feature is Lord Chaitanya. The center of the world is the birthplace of Lord Chaitanya. And everything, the further removed you are from that, the more remote you are. Right? And so this was Prabhupada's vision of the world. And so who can understand this? But how did the mercy of Lord Chaitanya come to us? It came to us through the mercy of his devotees, his Senapati Bhakta, right? Somebody who just gave their whole life trying to spread the teachings of Lord Chaitanya. So what does it mean to surrender to Lord Chaitanya also? What does it mean to be surrendered to the Hare Krishna movement or to Srila Prabhupada's mission in life? We hear from Lord Chaitanya, Yari Deka Taika, Krishna Upadesh, that whoever, wherever you go, whoever you meet, you should just teach them about Krishna. You should preach Krishna consciousness. Right? And what does this word preach mean? I think the word, this is a word that has many evolutions. When I think of a preacher, I think of Jim Casey. You guys know who Jim Casey is? Anybody know who Jim Casey is? Jim Casey was a character in John Steinbeck's Grapes of Wrath. He was the Grapes of Wrath is a book about a down-and-out family in Oklahoma that's traveling west across the Dust Bowl of America to seek better financial fortunes in the face of the industrialization of agriculture, which, of course, is a tale of Kali Yuga. So it talks about the industrialization of agriculture and how this knocked humans out of their normal biorhythms with the land, but it also talks a lot about corporate greed and the lengths that governments go to keep people subjugated while giving them the illusion of freedom and all this stuff. And anyway, one of the characters who was in this car going across the country was Jim Casey, who was described as a, quote, preacher. Like, this was his profession, was to go preach. And he gave this up because he saw so much hypocrisy amongst the preaching class, both within his own behavior and within the behavior of the other so-called preachers of the time. But throughout the book, Steinbeck would use Jim Casey as a vehicle for preaching the gospel, right? So preaching a little God consciousness and about the nature of humanity and love and life and all these things. And so we think of preaching of going out and like telling people about Krishna. Like sometimes I see people walking through Publix or whatever, it's just out in public, many people I see, and they have their little Prabhupada box with them on, and they have the Prabhupada box filled, you know, blasting it at full volume, walking around doing their errands in public. So, you know, they're getting Prabhupada hearing the holy name. And this is a form of preaching, and for sure people are getting purified by hearing the holy name from Srila Prabhupada in public, but it's also like a little weird. It's like people, like you see people looking like, what's going on over there? And so preaching should attract people to Krishna. Right, that's the first thing, is that we should try to attract people to Krishna. And that's actually really easy to do because Krishna is all attractive. Right? Everything about Krishna is attractive. So if we simply present Krishna as he is, people will automatically be attracted to Krishna. And in fact, this is one of the questions that the sages of Namashairanya asked Suta Goswami in the beginning of the Bhagavatam. Who would not be attracted by the nectarian pastimes of Krishna? Right? Like who doesn't want to imbibe this stuff? And the answer is that people who don't know about Krishna, they've never been exposed to it, they didn't know that they could imbibe the nectarian pastimes of Krishna, or demons, you know, people who are just like, demons, stay away, demons. So when Krishna is presented as he is, people will automatically be attracted. But what is Krishna? Who is Krishna as he is? Krishna is the unlimited Supreme Personality of Godhead. So therefore, he has unlimited features of as he is. So preaching really means to show somebody the aspect of Krishna that they need to see right now in order to come closer to him. And that takes some skill, right? that takes empathy, right? That takes the ability to listen to another person, not with the aim of wanting to respond to whatever this person is saying with my own intelligent quip, but to understand what this person is saying in order to help them come closer to Krishna. And so this is not easy. But we see that Srila Prabhupada was able to do this. We'll call him Guru Beta version, used to tell a story about how his he was in a marriage arranged quite abruptly by the reigning temple authorities of the time where he was living. And so there was him, there was the wife. Temple president said, "You're getting married on Sunday," and it was Friday or something, and so they got married on Sunday, and the wife's father was not happy about this, and he demanded to see Srila Prabhupada. The way the story was told to me is that he was, so this happened in Europe, I think Srila Prabhupada was in D.C. at the time when it happened, if I'm remembering the story correctly, and the wife's father lived in D.C., in the D.C. area, maybe it was Baltimore, something like this, I don't know. And so he went to see Prabhupada very angry that his daughter just married this total stranger in arranged marriage in this religious movement that Srila Prabhupada was starting. And he kind of like passed Srila Prabhupada's guards, like he threw Brahmananda to the side, Brahmananda, the big guy, and just went in and like demanded to speak to Srila Prabhupada. And Srila Prabhupada spent a few hours talking with this man to explain to him what the Krishna consciousness movement was, you know, the benefits that's happening, his social engineering strategies for getting people married, I guess, although Prabhupada had nothing to do with that aspect of the story. And the man left the meeting with such a deep appreciation for Srila Prabhupada that the way the story has been related to me is that till the end of the day, this man insisted that he knew Srila Prabhupada better than anybody. Like, Prabhupada was able to touch his heart so deeply, even though he went into the conversation in a justifiably irate state. We also hear in a letter that Srila Prabhupada wrote to Bharadvaj, the artist, in describing some of the past. Oh, no, this was not to Bharadvaj. This was to, I forgot. Anyway, it doesn't matter. But he wrote this letter where he was talking about preaching to higher classes, what he referred to as higher classes of people. And what he meant by higher classes of people was the academics of the world. He really wanted to reach educated people. And he said, educated people may be a little puffed up. And he said, that is okay. They've earned it. You know, so, you know, it's rare to find somebody who's very qualified. It is even more rare to find somebody who's very humble, and it is exceedingly rare to find somebody who is both very qualified and very humble. And so Prabhupada acknowledged that there may be very qualified people out there, although they might not be that humble. And he said, that's okay, they've earned it. And he said, but we should follow the example of Lord Chaitanya, who sat with Sarvabhauma Bhattacharya for days and listened to Sarvabhauma Bhattacharya preach Mayavadi nonsense without and Lord Chaitanya just sat there and listened for a long time, and he didn't say a word. He didn't say nothing, but actually, or he didn't voice his opinion. He just listened to Sarvabhauma Bhattacharya, and that was his preaching, right? So we tend to think of preaching as like going out and spreading the gospel. And it is that also. We should go out and spread the gospel. We should make Harinam. We should go distribute books. We should hold public programs. We should preach the philosophy of Krishna consciousness. But really bringing somebody to Krishna is a painstaking and long-term endeavor. And for that, we need a whole society, right? And so we can't do that. It cannot be the job only of the mendicants in the society to do this. The mendicants are like the lure, right? They're just the first line of all of this, you know, because people who work, you know, we don't have time to, you know, we have to work. We're building a society. We're building foundations. We're creating an economy. We're managing things. We're maintaining a structure. But the people who are on the front lines, their job is to bring people in, but then they need a whole structure behind them to help them. And so we need to find where we fit into this picture. This is, again, a detailed and complicated story that requires expert guidance from a spiritual master. And That's all I have to say today, I think, before the clock runs out. Thank you very much. Questions, comments, complaints, criticisms, donations. We get some... He was closer, sorry. You had your hand up first, I saw
that. I'm thinking that Bhagavatam explained or described the earth, and it described the universe. And so what we know is the earth, and what we know is, well, of course, the universe itself, we can't really properly define it. But from the Bhagavatam perspective, from Bhagavatam, we should, from what we gather, we should be able to say, well, is the solar system the universe, or is the Milky Way the universe, or are all the galaxies the universe? You know, I mean, the BI guy is supposed to do this thing, but I still think it's puzzling, because even the planet Earth itself, we can't come to a conclusion, you know, but I think Bhagavatam gave a description of the Earth, the planet, and it gave a description of the universe. And so, well, BI at least is supposed to reconcile the differences, you know, and give some justice to what we're perceiving and what's existing, and, you know, what Bhagavatam says. But I don't know. It seems like there are on a far, far journey yet.
just to the point about reconciling it all. Yeah. And so there's a lot in there of what you just said. Just to the point of reconciling it all, I feel I can speak for the current PI because I've been working with them for a long time, although I'm missing their conference now to speak to you. So this is an extension of that, we'll say. But as far as reconciling it all goes, the current thinking of this is that is a bit of a fool's errand. It's not meant to be reconciled. There's nothing in there to reconcile. There's different points of view about what it may all mean, and as a devotional sangha, we should be comfortable entertaining different points of view. Even Prabhupada said we should look at these things from all angles of vision. So the reconciliation is really in the sangha and discussing it in a mood that furthers our own devotion to Krishna. But you can have devotion to Krishna without knowing anything about the fifth canto of the Srimad Bhagavatam.
But just a minute, Lavi, you see, the thing is, we can't escape. I mean, divorce itself is talking about the universe, you know, but you explained that, well, Lord Brahma is made of intelligence, and he even can understand it or explain it to you. But my point is that the Bhagavatam, Sukadeva Goswami, gave a description of the universe. And he gave a description of the other planet, you know? And then we supposed to try our best, you know, as far as our understanding goes, you know, what's taking place. And you know, because you're trying to focus on the topic also. You know, we're not trying to run away from it.
Sure.
Focus and try to give justice to Bhagavatam and give justice to Prabhupada purport, you know, that's important.
So that is the important part. I think we are. I'm wondering if this, anyway. Thank you.
Hare Krishna.
Hare Krishna.
I was thinking about when you were speaking about the preaching and how it can't be done by just the renunciates, and it's a should be, and it's an important part of the movement in general. And I was just listening a couple of days ago to a lecture by Bhakti Vigyan Maharaj, where he was speaking about he's written a book about the seven purposes of ISKCON, and he was saying that's the thing, is that we as a movement, I mean, I couldn't even, to be honest, I couldn't quote all of them right now. You know, he was saying that's the problem, is that we need to make that more the central purpose of our lives. Yeah. That, you know, the being a part of this movement means really understanding those purposes and understanding how, okay, what can I do to contribute to that?
Jai. Yeah, thank you. Yeah, and I just to add one bit to that, most of those seven purposes of ISKCON are related to education.
Yes.
Yeah. So thank you. Yeah, for reminding us of that.
One thing you said earlier was science began or manifested after the World War One, more or less.
Science as a profession that people could endeavor to become a scientist as like a career. Yeah.
So would that be considered a diversion or a misdirection of the innate propensity one has for inquiring into the absolute truth? And Kali Yuga, it manifests in that way, the scientific method of cutting and dissecting and all the.
Yeah, I think you said the word diversion was the word you used.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think that's a little pejorative, maybe. Mm-hmm. I think if you look at religion with a big R. Over the course of history, unfortunately, that is the largest, religious institutions are the largest cause of atheism in the world today, as far as I'm concerned. People love God, right? Everybody loves Krishna. Everybody loves Krishna. That's why he's Krishna. We've forgotten this, but it's also not that difficult to remind somebody. Even a child can understand it, Prabhupada said. And in fact, children can understand it more easily because they haven't been polluted by the things of this world so much. And so their natural propensity to need to surrender to somebody, to want to be taken care of, to feel helpless, it's there in a child. That gets ruined, as people get older, in one way or another, unfortunately, largely, and Prabhupada correctly pointed out that largely due to our education system that gets ruined, which is again why education within ISKCON is, and making sure that ISKCON has strong schools is like number one preaching priority for any stable society. So in the 1960s and the 1970s, when we didn't have a society, we had vagabond followers of His Divine Grace. We were growing a society, but now we have a society. I like to affectionately refer to our beloved Mother Mukya not as the temple president, but as the mayor of Hare Krishna land, right? We have a whole city here. So cities need families and schools. Otherwise, you just have vagrants on the street, basically. Now, a vagrant on the street who is distributing Srila Prabhupada's books, that is glorious. But, that's what most Sankirtan devotees are in the eyes of our society. People driving around in a van, begging money off the streets, So doing that in Krishna's service is the perfection of that, and that is the great American adventure still. And so I would definitely encourage you all to get a van and go sell Prabhupada's books out on the street. But that's just one element of the society. If we want growth, if we want things beyond that, there needs to be structure and governance and justice and a constitution and an understanding of real family values and why this is important and why children are and why women are important. What is a society without women and children? It's nothing. It's useless. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You also said, wouldn't then, like Ayurveda was always there.
Yeah.
Wouldn't one who aspires to be an Ayurvedic doctor, they didn't think that, is there a word for science in Sanskrit?
I've often heard that a good translation of the word science in Sanskrit, or a translation of the word science in Sanskrit, is shastra. One of the myriad translations of the word shastra can also be science. Science can also be akin to Veda, which is different than Vedanta. And so we are talking about Vedanta. We are bhakti Vedantists, and Prabhupada wanted all of us to be qualified to assume this title. Bhaktivedanta. We have understood that the conclusion of knowledge, the Vedanta, is bhakti. Science doesn't have a conclusion. Science is a constantly iterative process. It's iterative and it's cumulative. So science builds upon itself, but because of the nature of what we're trying to perceive, it will never end. And so what it's devolved into, separate from the Einsteins and the Newtons and the truly great scientists of human history, is
basically academic bureaucrats trying to find some little nuance of something that nobody else has published yet, just because they need to get another publication out there if they want to maintain their job. And this is really bad in the scientists. And I didn't really make it as an academic, largely because I wasn't willing to do that. I was not willing to do that. I worked with scientists or engineers who would come up with an engineering model, which was a lot of work and which deserved to be published and which was a legitimate advance. And then they would change one variable in that model and publish another paper, and then change another variable in that model and publish another paper. And they'd get 100 papers, literally 100 papers out of doing this from just one, what was really one research project. And, I hate academic writing. Like, I don't use that word lightly. It's like I despise it. I will never write another academic paper in my life, thank God. But also, I wasn't willing to play that game. And that is what science has devolved into in large part in the modern world. So, Galileo, Copernicus, Newton, even Einstein, these were deeply faithful people. These people were not atheists. They were using what we know of as the scientific method in order to try to understand Krishna's creation. They were not using the scientific method in order to further their own sense gratification, which is what we use science for today, and medicine. So nobody wants to hear, somebody gets sick. My dad is a great example of this. My dad is old, older than many of you, most of you, I think. And he's not that healthy. And I keep telling him, you should maybe watch what you eat. If you're having gastrointestinal problems, maybe this is related to your diet. It's like, duh. I'm sure he's not listening to this right now, but I have told him this directly yet. It's like, obviously, if you're having gastrointestinal problems, this is related to what you're eating. And he just refuses to believe this. And the doctors are not helping my cause. They just give him another pill and another pill and another pill so he can go on eating whatever nonsense he wants. And this is the state of the medicine of the world. We just keep people alive because they think they're going to enjoy another 2 or 3 years of their life when they're in their 90s. I don't think so, right? And so the scientific method and scientific discoveries in and of themselves are not bad. It's what we do with them that makes them good or bad. Anyway, rant over on that point. Any last points? Yes?
I just want to clarify. Yeah. You said that science as a profession started at the end of the 19th century, did you say that?
I said the word science became prevalent in the English language towards the end of the 19th century, and it became like a viable career option for people in the run-up to, and especially in the aftermath of World War I. And this is because in America, America entered World War I kind of at the end as an afterthought, but there was a rampant, growth of the military-industrial complex at that time, and this required engineers and scientists.
But before then, there was scientific research and experiments going on.
Absolutely. They did not really call it science. They did not really call it science until towards the end of the 19th century. They called it natural philosophy. Absolutely. The scientific method was developed hundreds of years earlier, beginning with Francis Bacon and in that time period. It's a natural outcome of the Renaissance.
Age of rationalism began around the time of...
The age of rationalism actually grew out of... So kind of it was kind of between the Renaissance and the Age of Enlightenment that the scientific method started to become codified as a genuinely accepted practice. But it wasn't really until the Industrial Revolution came on that it became like a niche of its own. It was called natural philosophy, and it was an empirically based part of the humanities. And so this is also just one last point I'll make about the BI, is that, we talk about doing scientific research, but in reality, the BI is not equipped to do any scientific research. Really, the BI is looking at the philosophy and the culture of science. To do real scientific research along the lines, and I'm sorry that Trivikrampapu left, but maybe he'll listen online. To do real scientific research to, show, what is really the structure of Bhumandala from a scientific perspective requires not only equipment that we don't have, but equipment that probably doesn't exist anywhere and would need to be developed. And so that's where the science comes in. Really, we were talking about these things from the perspective of hermeneutics, how to interpret scripture. Is the Bhagavatam meant to be taken literally in these lines? And I think this is a question for another day. Hare Krishna. Sri Chaitanya Charitamrita Ki Jai.